You know, in many senses, this is has been an appropriate week for the beginning of Holy Week. There's joy and there's sorrow. There's the joy of three people publicly professing their faith in Jesus Christ. And there are two people known to us and dear to us who have passed away. And I hope you feel that this morning. And I hope that you know that it's all right to feel those things this morning, and it's appropriate to feel those things this morning. It actually helps us to be drawn into what is happening here in this passage. You know, as I was preparing this passage this week, I was on a phone call with a friend of mine in the UK who's also involved in ministry, and he preaches a lot as well. And he said, look, I would rather preach from any other part of the Bible than the Gospels, because sometimes they are hard to understand. With a New Testament letter, you can reason it out. You can see how it fits together, and you can kind of reason the argument out. With an Old Testament narrative, there's all these wonderful things happening, but when you're faced with something like the thing that we're faced with this morning, it can be hard to interpret. In a sense, it's simple. Jesus is dying, and he's dying for us. But it's also so profound. And this happening of the cross is difficult to interpret, even though it's at the center of our faith. It's at the center of everything we believe. There was a PBS documentary that kind of put it this way. It said, Christianity is the only major religion to have as its central focus the suffering and degradation of its God. The crucifixion is so familiar to us and so moving that it is hard to realize how unusual it is as an image of God. Well, how can you tell it's unusual? It may not seem that unusual for us, but how could you tell it's unusual? Well, look at what the crowds are doing here in this 23rd chapter of Luke's Gospel. They're standing by and they're watching. They're looking. Actually, the word that's used there for to look actually means to try and make sense, to theorize about what is going on in front of them. They're seeing something that's happening and they don't understand it. You see, even Jesus says it when he says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I'm right in front of them, and they don't understand it. You see, it's unusual. It is so unusual what is happening before them that they don't get it. That's the danger for the people that were around during Jesus' time. This is so unique. This is so strange, in a sense, that they don't get it. But there's a danger for you and I as well. You see, for us, the cross can just be reduced to an inspiring religious symbol. For us, Easter happens every year. Holy Week happens every year. For you and for me, it's our familiarity with the cross that means that we may not actually understand it. You see, they were eyewitnesses, and they failed to understand. You and I have the eyewitness accounts right here, reliably, carefully put in front of us, and we can fail to understand it as well. You know, we can be looking at the cross this morning. We can be viewing the baptisms that are going to happen later and miss their significance. So let me ask you this question. How do you know that you've responded in the right way? How can you know that you've seen what Jesus is doing here and that you've responded in the right way? How can you know that you've gotten it? Everyone else is not getting it. How do you know that you've gotten it? How do you know that you've received him? Because what Luke is doing here this morning is he is confronting us with the cross. You know, we've been going through this series looking for the kingdom, and we've been presented with many different pieces of eyewitness evidence that is showing us and telling us something about Jesus. And here at the crucifixion, at the climax of the whole gospel, Luke is laying it in front of us. And he's saying, look, you've got all the evidence. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to respond to it? You see, in this story, in the 23rd chapter, in this story itself, we're going to see two major ways that you can respond to what Jesus is doing here. Two major ways to respond to the king. You either reject him or receive him. Reject the king or receive the king. And we're going to take these two categories that I just mentioned, and we're going to uncover who rejects Jesus and why, and who it is that receives Jesus and why. Those two simple things, rejecting him and receiving him. Who does it and why? And who receives him and why? Look down with me at verses 35 through 38. See, there's something in this passage that ties all of the people who reject Jesus together. I wonder if you caught that. It's this phrase, if you are the Christ, or if you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. Those conditional statements are all over this passage. All of them use the word if in some form, and all of them call into question the identity of Jesus, who he is. You see, in the people's minds, there's a test that they have for Jesus, and he is failing it. And the first group of scoffers, the first group of people to ask Jesus this question, Luke calls the rulers. The rulers. And this means that the chief priests, the religious experts, the Pharisees, they're these religious elite, educated, powerful, wealthy, moral, sophisticated people. And here is the test that they have. Verse 35, he saved others. Let him save himself if he's the Christ of God, his chosen one. You see, you can see in that what their expectation of the Messiah was. You can see in that what their expectation of the king was. They thought that the Messiah would be successful, triumphant, that he would cast out the Romans, that he would conquer, that his kingdom would be one of military might. And that was the opposite of what they were looking at. See, their major test for whether Jesus was the king or not was if we can put him to death in the most shameful, degrading, dehumanizing way possible, he cannot be the Messiah. And that is exactly what they're looking at. There's actually a New Testament professor called G.K. Beale who helps explain this for us, because it can be quite hard for us to understand why they felt this strongly about a crucified man. But this is what he says. Those in Israel who committed sins worthy of death were not only to be stoned to death, but subsequently hung on a tree until sundown in order to demonstrate the shame and disgrace of the crime. And this is the important point. Such a person was the most accursed of God in the whole nation. Most Jews would have identified Jesus as deserving this cursed death because he blasphemed by ascribing to himself the title of Messiah and the divine Son of God. And such an accursed one could not possibly have been the true Son of God, they thought, since God would never allow his true Son to unjustly undergo such a cursed, shameful punishment of hanging on a tree. Such a punishment was reserved for the most heinous of criminals. Do you see what he's saying there? In their minds, God's anger was reserved for lawbreakers and sinners. It wasn't reserved for the Messiah. It wasn't reserved for God's chosen one. The Christ could never be treated like a criminal. It was impossible. God would never let his chosen one die such a weak, godless death. See, so Jesus must have been a godless reject. Do you see the connection that's happening in their minds? A equals B. You see, to be chosen in these religious people's minds meant to be choice. It meant to be someone of upstanding moral character who could never be accused of blasphemy. But here is Jesus dying. How could he be the Messiah, they're thinking, if he can't even save himself? If he's supposed to save the nation of Israel, how can he do that when he's hanging on a cross? Who would follow such a joke? Such a joke. Do you get it? Do you get it? You see, their religion, their view of religion, their view of how God works is essentially triumphalistic. It's political. And that stops them from understanding their cross. Their whole concept of religion told them that only those strong enough to keep the law could achieve salvation. And by the way, that is true of almost all major religions. Only those moral enough, wise enough, intelligent enough, and strong enough to keep all the rules will please God. But you see, the irony here is that the Pharisees don't understand that nobody is strong enough to keep the law. See, Jesus' salvation here is being accomplished in weakness. It's being accomplished through degradation, and it can be only received in weakness. It can only be received in weakness. By the way, that is why you can be a child and become a Christian. Children, let's face it, in many ways are weak. But you don't have to be strong to receive the gospel. Can you see that? These Pharisees, these religious rulers can't. They wanted Easter Sunday without Good Friday. They wanted hope without its necessary dialogue with despair. They wanted a crown without a cross. They wanted glory without suffering. That kind of religion, my friends, has nothing to offer people in the world. 2020 and the beginning of 2021 have proven that. A triumphalistic religion has nothing to offer the world, but a religion that can be received, a God that can be received, a gospel that can be received in weakness by even children has something profound to offer the real world. So that's the first group of people that reject Jesus. Let's have a look at the second group now in verse 37. Verse 36 and 37, their test is similar. See the soldiers here? They mock Jesus and they tell him, essentially, get yourself out of this. If you're the king, save yourself. They say, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself. They offer him sour wine, which was only on offer to the poorest of people, which is in itself a mockery, and they call upon him to save himself. They scoff at him in the same way that the religious rulers scoffed at himself, but from a different perspective. See, if the Pharisees can be seen as the kind of religious, triumphalistic response to the King Jesus, this could be seen as the kind of secular, almost non-religious response to him. You see, in the minds of the Roman soldiers, it was laughable that such a weakling could claim to be king. It was absolutely ridiculous. He couldn't possibly stand up to the might and power of the Roman Empire, let alone the Roman governor. Now, I want you to think about the examples that these soldiers had in their lives, of the kingdoms that they were a part of, Herod and Caesar. And if you read anything about Herod and Caesar, you will know that they love a strong man. See, in those days, to be a king was to overcome your enemies with military power and might. It was to be so politically subtle and conniving and to bribe and assassinate and conquer your way to the top. That was their framework. That was their example of who became a king. Great empires like Persia and Babylon and Rome got where they were because their kings overcame their enemies. And yet here they see as someone called the King of the Jews, and by the way, Luke notes the irony because affixed above Jesus on the cross is, this is the King of the Jews. But they could not conceive of a king that was overcome by his enemies. See, for them, a king overcame his enemies and came into his kingdom. But a king could never be overcome by his enemies to come into their kingdoms. You see, at the core of their kingdom was brute force and power and triumph. But at the core of Jesus' kingdom is weakness and sacrifice and suffering. And they just can't make sense of it. And you always mock what you don't or you aren't able to make sense of. You always mock what you can't make sense of. You either fear it or you mock it. They would have seen the cross as laughable. But here is the King of the Jews, loving his enemies, arms outstretched, dying on a cross. At the core of his kingdom is weakness and sacrifice. Now, I've said this before, irony is a key part of Luke's gospel. You won't understand what's going on here if you don't get that there is irony involved. And there's a real irony here because these two disparate groups who would have hated each other, the religious rulers, the Jewish religious rulers, and the people who were oppressing them, the Roman military rule, are agreeing on something. Do you see that? What are they agreeing on? They're agreeing on the fact that this man can't possibly be the king. The rulers and the soldiers, the oppressed and the oppressors are both agreeing that this is not how God saves. They're both making the same mistake. Now, there was a theologian that I was reading about this called Fleming Rutledge, and she sums it up in this way. It's a really good summary. She says, religious people want visionary experiences and spiritual uplift. Secular people want proofs, arguments, demonstrations, philosophy, science. The striking fact is that neither one of these groups wants to hear about the cross. Neither one of them. You see, these two groups of people who hated each other all agreed on this one thing. This can't be the savior of the world. This can't be the king of the coming kingdom. This is not the way God would go about saving people. See, Tim Keller, who's a church planter in New York, makes an amazing observation here. This shows that no matter where you are on the spectrum, whether you're left or right, no matter what side of the culture war you are on, the gospel makes no sense. No matter who you are, no matter where you fall on the range of human opinion, the gospel makes no sense. Liberal and conservative alike don't get it. See, traditional people love the part of the gospel message which is, we're sinners. We are wretched sinners deserving of judgment. They love that part of it. But the part they hate is that anyone can receive forgiveness. It doesn't matter how moral you are. It doesn't matter how profoundly you've failed. You don't have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and just try harder. You can be saved by grace. They think, hang on a second, that's not how God works. But you see, it's equally the same on the left. The secular person likes the second part. They love the second part about how God is gracious, slow to anger, rich in love, that his son would forgive his enemies even as he dies for them. They say, yes, that is what a God should be like. But they hate that part about us being sinners. Do you see, no matter who you are, no matter where you're from, the gospel looks nuts. People don't understand it. It looks crazy. Jesus looks, just as Jesus looks foolish to the people of his day, listen, any one of you, any one of us who wants to follow Jesus today is going to look stupid. You are going to be mocked. You are going to be misunderstood. I want you to understand that. Both those people being baptized today and those of us who have been Christians for a long time, you're going to be misunderstood. Have you counted the cost? Just as they mocked Jesus and didn't understand what was going on, they will mock you and misunderstand you as well. And don't let that give you a persecution complex. That's not what the point is. The point is to understand that you will be misunderstood and to keep following your king into this kingdom of weakness and sacrifice and forgiving your enemies. Nobody with a persecution complex forgives their enemies. They just come up with a conspiracy theory. But here is a man saying, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they do. Is that going to be your response when they hate you and persecute you and misunderstand you because they know you're a Christian? Will that be your response? It was Jesus' response. People thought it was insane for the Christ to die this death. They will think it is insane for you to follow him. And by the way, if people at the moment aren't thinking that you're insane for following Christ, we have to ask ourselves the question, are we really following him in the way that we're supposed to? You know, are our lives incomprehensible to people? Or do people look at our lives and say, yeah, that makes sense? Maybe we're more religious than we are following the gospel at that point. It's something to think about. Look, listen. All of these reactions of the people that reject Jesus are driving home the godlessness and the how nuts it is of the cross. Jew and Gentile alike, religious people and secular people, reject it as God's way of saving people because it doesn't fit their idea of how God works. It doesn't fit their idea of how a king would act. Listen, we've got to remember, for the people seeing the cross back then, they wouldn't have interpreted it like we would have. They wouldn't have seen it as this inspiring act of love. They wouldn't have seen it as a comforting religious symbol. It would have been the total opposite. It would have been an absolute horror to them. It would have been an absolute scandal to them. You know, talk about cancel culture. This is the ultimate getting canceled in Roman culture. It is the most degrading, the most dehumanizing thing possible. It's meant to remove every vestige of humanity that somebody had as they hang naked for everyone to see publicly on a cross. That's how it would have been interpreted. It's like walking past somebody's lawn today and seeing a burning cross or a man lynched on a tree. It's that shocking. Do you know that? And do you know that if you follow that lynched God, you will be seen as just as weird and just as worthy of mockery and shame as he was? People don't understand it, so they reject it as God's way of salvation. Listen, it's clear that there are many ways in which people reject Jesus, and there's many reasons for which they do that, but they all stem from being unable to understand who the Messiah is. Even if they're looking right at him. You might be here this morning and you might not be a Christian. You might be looking at the same words on a page that we're looking at and you might not get it yet. Stick with it. Try and understand it. Try to take it in because it is worth everything. It is worth everything. Because you see, there's only one person here who gets it. Did you catch it? There's only one person in this whole account that we've read who understands who Jesus is. Now let's look at this person. Let's look at this person who received Jesus as king and why he gets it. Look at verses 39 to 43. See, the mystery here is that at this moment of absolute agony and absolute degradation, one of the criminals dying with Jesus recognizes who he is. One of these men understands the gospel and responds to Jesus. And we should be asking ourselves, well, hang on, what makes this guy so special? What makes it so that this man understands it and nobody else here has? Well, in a sense, nothing. He's a human sinner just like everyone else. We don't even know this criminal's name. So in a sense, nothing makes him special. But if you contrast him with the other criminal next to Jesus, something profound emerges. Look down at verse 39. The first criminal reviles Jesus for being powerless. He says, like the others, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." Do you see what he's doing? He's going along with the crowd. He's saying what everyone else is saying. He's challenging Jesus in exactly the same way everyone else is challenging him. And like them, he has a very simple test. Get me out of this. Get me out of this, and then I will believe. Do you know many people do that when it comes to belief in God? Many people will say, "I'll serve you if you give me this thing." Listen, if you're really God, show yourself. Deliver me from this sickness. Give me that relationship that I really want. Give me that position or job that I really want. It's the if. It's the conditional. Many people come to Jesus with a condition. They place conditions upon believing him. That is essentially idolatry. It's essentially coming to something else as your real God other than Jesus. See, when we say, "God, just get me into that school, or give me that relationship, or deliver me from this ailment," we're using God as a means to get what we really want, which is actually the real God in our life. And that criminal is doing exactly that. But you see, the second criminal doesn't make this mistake. There is no request of him being saved from that moment. He actually finds, in this moment of agony, time to rebuke the other guy and tell him off as he's hanging on the cross. I mean, that's astounding. So what does this second criminal know that the first criminal doesn't? Have you ever asked that question? I think he knows two things. He knows he is deserving of God's judgment for his crimes and that Jesus is innocent. Look at what he says in verses 40 and 41. "Do you not fear God, seeing as we are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." He knows that he is getting what he deserves. That's the difference. Can you see? You can see that because he does the opposite of the other criminal. He doesn't lay down any ultimatums. He says, in effect, "Even if you don't get me out of this, Jesus, I will still serve you. Just as I'm hanging, dying on this cross next to you, I will still receive you as king." Do you see how he places no conditions on following and responding to Jesus? And did you notice, in effect, that both criminals want to be saved? One immediately and one ultimately. See, the one of them thinks that it's his immediate physical condition that needs to be relieved. The other knows that it's his ultimate spiritual and eternal condition that is related to the kingdom of God that needs to be relieved. See, both want to be saved, but only one knows what that truly means. Everyone else in this story sees Jesus getting what he deserves. Only one man sees Jesus getting what he deserves, he personally as a criminal. And he understands that there is an exchange going on. And that brings us to the second thing that this criminal knows. He knows Jesus is suffering innocently. In the second half of verse 41, what does he say? "This man has done nothing wrong." If you read the crucifixion accounts from Jesus' trial onwards, his innocence is repeated over and over and over again so that you cannot miss it. If you've missed it up until now, I can't help you. But let me say, Jesus is innocent, and this is what this criminal understands. Jesus the King dies alongside us, being numbered with the transgressors. No king dies alongside his subjects, let alone for people who reject him. Here is Jesus dying alongside one criminal who rejects him and one criminal who accepts him. He himself becomes the bridge between an unrighteous criminal and a righteous criminal. How do you go from being an unrighteous criminal to being a righteous criminal? From being a sinner to a saved sinner? It is Jesus Christ on the cross. That is the bridge. Actually, there's a poet whom I love called George Herbert who puts this so beautifully in a poem called The Sacrifice. And it's a meditation on Easter. And he says this, "Between two thieves I spend my utmost breath, as he that for some robbery suffereth. Alas, what have I stolen from you? Death. Was ever grief like mine?" You see, these robbers would not have been on the cross just for robbing somebody. That is not a capital offense back then. A capital offense would be as if they had killed someone while robbing them. These criminals were dying because they had stolen someone's life from them. Jesus is dying to steal death from these people. That is the major difference. What have I stolen from you? Death. Was ever grief like mine? And what does this lead this criminal to do? He throws himself on Jesus' mercy. He asks him in verse 42, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Remember me when you come into your kingdom." Now, I think this moment in the Gospels has often been done a misjustice. It's often been misread as kind of being able to put off Jesus till you're older. By the way, the three people being baptized this morning put pay to that lie. People have often said, well, I'll just put it off until I'm on my deathbed. I have a friend who works in the ER departments in the United Kingdom. And let me tell you, putting off Jesus until your deathbed is extremely rare. Deathbed conversions are extremely, extremely rare, because what happens is you're medicated. You're unconscious. You are unable to make a meaningful, in many ways, response to Jesus in those moments. If you're here this morning and you're thinking, I'll just put it off like this thief did until I'm dying, don't do that. You may not have the chance. That is not what this passage is saying. The point here is that even a man so thoroughly wretched that he's being put to death for stealing someone's life can be forgiven. That is the point that's being made here. Don't misread it. Even this criminal can have his sins washed away, even as he is dying and receiving the penalty for the crime that he committed. Think about it. If this criminal can become a Christian, anyone can become a Christian. It's too late for him to clean up his act. He can't go to synagogue and learn all the rules and do all the things and then come to Jesus. It's far too late for that, which means that nobody is out of reach of God's grace. It doesn't matter how young and inexperienced you are. In a sense, it doesn't matter how old and set in your ways you are. Anyone can come to Jesus. It's never too late, because God's grace reaches this criminal in the most extreme place. And what does he do? Nothing but throw himself on Jesus' mercy. All he asks for is to be remembered. Everyone else in this story wants a display of power. They want Jesus to finally prove that he's the Messiah, and they don't understand that that's exactly what he's doing. Except this criminal. This convicted, guilty criminal simply wants to be remembered by the king. He says, in effect, I deserve to be cast out, so take me in. I deserve to be left aside, so bring me to your side. That is what it means to become a Christian. That is the paradox of becoming a Christian. By the way, if you want to become a Christian this morning, that is really what you're saying, in effect. I deserve to be cast out. I know I'm deserving of judgment. Jesus, I know you're innocent. Take me in, even though I deserve to be cast out. See, another theme in Luke's gospel, and I want you to know this, is it's about the outcasts, the racial minorities, the moral minorities. They're the ones who understand who Jesus is. It's the outcasts who are brought into the kingdom. The criminal, the moral outcast, receives the reward for Jesus' kingdom, which is paradise with him. Jesus receives the reward for the criminal's deeds, which is punishment hanging on a cross, and the wrath of God as it happens. Not just physical agony, but spiritual agony as well. And the hymn that we sing is so proven true at this moment. The vilest offender who truly believes that moment from Jesus, a pardon receives. What does he say to him? Today, you will be with me in paradise. You don't have to clean up your act, because my act has cleaned up your act. The vilest offender who truly believes that moment from Jesus, a pardon receives. And this vile offender, because he is a vile offender, out of all the others in the story, receives paradise. But look at where he's receiving it. He's receiving paradise in the midst of hell on earth, in the midst of the deepest physical agony that a human being can be experiencing. He is receiving paradise. As Rick was dying this week, he was receiving paradise. Even in the midst of his suffering, as his body wasted away, he was being renewed in his inner man day by day. And today, he is in paradise with his Savior. Listen, Christianity is not just a set of rules that you need to follow. It is a power at work in you that will give you the endurance to suffer even the most painful of penalties and death itself with grace and poise and hope, because that is what is happening here. See, the criminal got so much more than he asked for. Paradise with Jesus today, even as he hangs on a cross. How can we know this is true? Because Jesus is dying alongside him. Jesus' death wipes away all the sins of this criminal, this guilty criminal, so that even as he's hanging on a cross, even though mankind is condemning him, God sees him as pure and beautiful. In his ugliest moment, the Father looks on him as he receives the forgiveness of Jesus and loves him. That is what it means to be a Christian. You are justified. Simul justus et peccator. You are simultaneously a sinner and righteous at the same time, because God is dying alongside you. I'm sure that comforted Rick in his last days as well. Listen, I realize there's so much to take in here this morning. I realize that it's a heavy moment for us all, but I want you to understand it. And I want to leave you with this question. Whether you're not a Christian yet, whether you are a Christian, whether you're just exploring Christianity, whether you're going to make that public profession today, how are you going to respond? How are you going to respond to Jesus? Have you responded to Jesus this morning? Actually, these baptisms that we're going to see are a sign and a symbol of how you respond. Baptism is something that happens to you. It's not something that you do yourself. It's not this great act that you do for Jesus. It is a picture of how Jesus has washed you. It's a picture of how his death has redeemed you. That is one way to respond. Maybe if you've been exploring Christianity for a while, why not think about getting baptized? If you haven't responded to Jesus yet, maybe during these baptisms, maybe during this service is the time where you, in your own heart, like the criminal on the cross, say to Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." If you're joining us online and that's you, I urge you to do that even now. And what about those of us who have been going through Lent and Easter year after year, who would say that we follow Jesus? Have we responded rightly? Do we need to get it some more? Does it need to be driven more deeply into our hearts? My answer to that, as I've been preparing it this week, is yes, Lord. Yes, it does. It can always go deeper into our hearts. There's always a level down which it can drop into our hearts as well. Listen, we're going to move into a time of baptizing people now. And I don't want you to just miss what is happening here. I want you to be prayerfully thinking about it. As these people who have gotten it are baptized, I want you to think about how we can be getting it as well, and how we can be leading others to get it, even sharing this passage with them and the wonderful grace of Jesus with them this week as well. Listen, Jesus has given his all for you. How are you going to respond to him?